Committee for Monday, May 21st, 2007. We've got a number of bills up for hearing and work session this morning, and we're going to hop around a bit based on some scheduling issues for people who are involved in those. With apologies to people, it's a little hard to predict even just what order we're going to be going in, but except that we're going to start out with Senate Bill 347A. I'll open a public hearing on SB 347A.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 347A relates to test instruments in DUI prosecutions. In driving under the influence of intoxicants prosecutions, the state often relies on evidence gleaned from certain test instruments that measure the amount of alcohol within a person's breath and then extrapolate from that the amount of alcohol in the person's blood, otherwise known as BAC, or blood alcohol content. Oregon recently switched to machines known as the Intoxilizer 8000, which replaced the previous Intoxilizer 5000. Blood and urine are typically extracted and analyzed through different processes and mechanisms. In DUI prosecutions, defense attorneys will often request, as part of discovery, that the state turn over any and all information relating to the particular instrument that was used to test a defendant's BAC. Such information can include the crime lab's maintenance records for the machine. Senate Bill 347A clarifies that certain information relating to these test instruments is not discoverable or admissible. Specifically, this information includes 1. The source code or other software for the test instrument. 2. Schematics, trade secrets, or other proprietary information regarding the test instrument. And 3. Any documents or information relating to the test instrument that is not in the possession of a law enforcement agency administering the test. In essence, this bill is a way to try to say you can't get stuff that is exclusively proprietary or that the manufacturer has, but if the state has it in its possession, you can get it from the state. My understanding is that Ms. Christian with OCDLA has spoken with Senator Przanski, who's the original sponsor of the bill, about amending the language somewhat in a manner consistent with what I believe Florida has done, and that amendment is not yet available, but the idea will be the same.
Very good. Mr. Neely, why don't you come tell us more about this bill?
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Neely representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Senate Bill 347 does precisely what Council Stanford described. This bill is a bit of a preemptive strike. I hate to use the word strike. It's more of a preemptive defense against these sorts of challenges. What I can tell you is in the state of Florida, there was a successful challenge along the lines of seeking the information, the source code information, for the Intoxilizer 8000. That source code information was not in the possession of the law enforcement agency nor the district attorney in that area. Consequently, they had to turn to the company that produces the Intoxilizer 8000. That company would not turn over that information for reasonable reasons. The technology behind these breathalyzers is advancing at relatively quick rates. For example, just a few years ago, the breathalyzers couldn't tell one person's breath versus another person's breath. Today's technology allows these machines to actually identify the individual who's breathing into them, who's blowing. So that's just an example of the way the technology is advancing. It's a highly competitive marketplace. Consequently, as I said, this company wouldn't disclose the source code, which has nothing to do with the accuracy of the tests. In the end, what happened is it ground the system to a halt. Florida had to stop using their Intoxilizer 8000s or Intoxilizer 5000s. I can't remember which one was at question. And it caused some real significant problems in Florida. They went ahead and changed the law in Florida. Senator Przanski identified that in media article, introduced Senate Bill 347. We strongly support the bill. Again, it shouldn't have any impact on the actual disposition of these cases. We've worked and will continue to work with OCDLA to try and find a manageable solution. I got a chance to look at Ms. Christian's amendments this morning. What they're going to look like, I should say, not the actual amendments. They're not back yet. They seem to be fine. I think, again, our goal is to protect that information that is in the company's records that's proprietary to that company, not the information that's in any district attorney's office or any sheriff's office or any law enforcement agency. anything that is in the possession of those organizations will readily disclose through the course of discovery. With that, if you have any questions, I'd be more than happy to try and answer them.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Neely, it's kind of hard to talk about the amendment without looking at it, but I wonder if it addresses the concern that I have, which is about the breadth of Section 3. Completely understand the source code and software, the trade secrets, but Section 3 is any documents or information relating to the instrument. So I just am wondering if that amendment is going to address that concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the answer is yes.
Thank you.
And I'll let Ms. Christian describe the amendments.
Okay. Any further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Neely.
Ms. Christian.
Okay.
Can we work together to get things fixed?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I first want to thank Senator Przanski for working with Oregon criminal defense lawyers on amendments to this bill. And the primary concern that OCDLA had was twofold. Number one is, as Representative Bonamici indicated, on lines 12 and 13 of Senate Bill 347A and Gross, subsection 3 is very broad. It's not limited to proprietary or trade secrets with regard to the manufacture of the intoxilizer. An example would be a manual for the intoxilizer, which is very helpful for defense attorneys to have. And so the amendments that Senator Przanski has agreed to does address that breadth problem. The second area of concern that we had was with the fact that under this bill, information, and let's talk about a manual rather than proprietary information or trade secrets. So a manual for this intoxilizer would not be admissible at all under any circumstances in a case of DUII. And I think of an analogy of a civil case where I have an accident, a car accident, and I truly believe that I did nothing wrong. And I think of, I don't know if you remember the Dodge Durangos, where I believe a person would be driving along and all of a sudden the car would just turn on its own. So if I were involved in an accident and people felt that it was my fault and I was sued, I certainly would want to be able to get information out of Chrysler or Dodge to show that, in fact, the accident was not my fault. The bill as currently drafted, the A.N. Gross, if I applied this to a DUII case, I would not be able to get that information out of Chrysler. In talking with Senator Przanski, that was not his intent. So what I did with regard to amendments, and I apologize for the fact that they aren't here, legislative counsel didn't have time to get them done, and there are some issues, or language, rather, that needs to be addressed today. Number one, Senator Przanski wanted to make sure that a DUII case would never be dismissed simply because the defense attorney subpoenaed, for example, the CEO of the company that manufactures the intoxilizer. So the first amendment reads, a DUII case may not be dismissed because a witness who is subpoenaed by the defendant to provide testimony with respect to an instrument that was used to test the person's breath for the purpose of determining the alcohol content of the person's blood is not available, so a case would not be dismissed, or because documentation that is subpoenaed by the defendant with respect to an instrument that was used to test the person's breath for the purpose of determining the alcohol content of the person's blood is not received. So in other words, if a defense attorney subpoenas someone from the manufacturer, CMI Incorporated in Kentucky, I believe, and that person fails to show up in court, the case would not be dismissed. This is nothing. The subpoenaing of, like, an executive or anyone with the manufacturer, to my knowledge, has not occurred in Oregon. And as Mr. Neely said, I believe all of the concern is, in fact, preemptive. The final two parts of the amendment would just in the current what are called discovery statutes that set forth what a district attorney must provide to a defense, to a defendant or his or her counsel, it makes it clear what the district attorney has to provide to defense counsel. And what we're trying to do, Senator Prezansky and I, is have the information with regard to the intoxilizer be that which the DAs currently are providing defense counsel, so that there's no change at all in current practice. And finally, there'll be an amendment to the statute that sets forth what the district attorney doesn't have to give to defense counsel, and it includes manuals, schematics, source codes, or software of the instrument used to test the breath of a person who is charged with DUI, or any other material on the instrument that is not in the actual possession of the state, meaning the DA, and information on the instrument that is in the possession of the manufacturer of the test instrument. Again, the intent behind Senator Prezansky's bill was to limit that information that the DA's office has to provide counsel. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Counsel.
Ms. Christian, just one question, actually two questions. One, the amendment that you're drafting excludes manuals from having to be produced?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee and council, it excludes the district attorney from having to provide the manuals. So defense counsel would still be free, if you will, to subpoena a manual from the manufacturer. But it makes it clear that the district attorney has no responsibility to be calling up CMI or contacting the manufacturer to get anything for defense counsel.
If I can follow up with that, here's one question. Ms. Christian, I understand you and I have spoken about the breadth of subsection 3 of the A. and Gross bill. Mm-hmm. But one, and you talked about manuals being a concern, mm-hmm. but just to be clear, do you think that manuals, the Oregon State Police is the agency that administers the tests.
Correct.
And in connection with receiving the intoxilizer 8,000 machines from the manufacturer, if the manufacturer gives the manuals to the Oregon State Police in connection with giving them the machine, then under the A. and Gross version of the bill, that has to be produced because it's in the possession of the state. If the Oregon State Police has the manual, they have to give it up.
Chair McPherson and counsel, you're absolutely right. If they have the manual, it would be, quote, discoverable. And then the issue goes into the admissibility provision in Senate Bill 347.
Ms. Christian, this may be a question for Mr. Neely, but I'm just trying to understand what the purpose of the bill is. Is it to protect proprietary information? So that because otherwise we won't be able to purchase the best equipment? Is that the concern?
Mr. Chair.
Maybe Mr. Neely, maybe you could come and help me understand this. I'm trying to understand why, recognizing that some of this information may be highly technical and not really relevant to a defense of a prosecution, but why wouldn't we want to have any of this information available?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think the issue is twofold. One, it's proprietary information. It's the actual source code, and as the owner of a software company, I can tell you that I'm not going to be in any hurry to give up my source code. That information is not in the possession of the state, of any aspect of the state's business. Consequently, we would have to turn to the company to give that information over to our offices in the course of discovery. The company is not likely to give us that information, and that can cause the system to grind to a standstill. We can't move any of these cases forward. We can't use the intoxilizer 8000 to measure the blood alcohol content because we can't get the information that the courts and the defense bar would be requesting in the course of these cases. That's what happened in Florida, is essentially they had to terminate the use of the intoxilizer. It caused an incredible problem in the course of their law enforcement activity. They couldn't do breathalyzer tests.
Right.
So
yeah.
That's the key issue here.
Yeah. So it's that the manufacturer
what doesn't want to reveal information about that's proprietary to its business, and if it refuses to do that, then law enforcement is going to be denied access to the best equipment that's available.
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right.
Okay. So why would a manual need to be protected? Why wouldn't a manual be something that ought to be freely available from anyone?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're perfectly happy to turn over the manual and do regularly, as I understand it, if it's in our possession.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Ms. Christian, if you could. It seems like the bill may be broader than it really needs to be to protect the interest, which is to make sure that the manufacturer is not having to reveal things that it would not want to have out in the public domain.
And Mr. Chair, when Senator Prezansky presented his bill first before Senate Judiciary, I came away with the understanding that indeed that was his concern. In further discussions with him, however, it became clear that he had a greater concern with regard to dismissal of a DUII case, and that's why we simply, OCDLA simply said, let's have a provision that says if the circumstance is that the defendant's attorney has subpoenaed the CEO of CMI and that person doesn't file a motion to quash the subpoena or doesn't show up, then as a matter of law, the DUII case will not be dismissed. So it was broader than just the proprietary concern that Senator Prezansky had. And I do want to add that this was an issue in Florida with some courts, and it's like so many new things in the law. There were courts, based on what I read that Senator Prezansky provided to Senate Judiciary, there were some courts who did put DUII cases on hold because of concerns about proprietary information. There are other courts that ruled that defense counsel wasn't entitled to source codes and these proprietary matters. And so Florida resolved this difference in court rulings by a statutory provision, which is the model that we've used for the last two sections of the amendment. We've used Florida's fix, if you will.
So that really I've identified now two purposes. One is to protect proprietary information. Another is to avoid creating opportunities for people charged with DUII to avoid prosecution by claiming that they need to have access to information and individuals from the maker of the equipment, and thereby, because that if that company doesn't respond effectively, then they dodge the rap.
That's correct.
Okay, well, a little slow this morning, but I think I'm getting there. Any further questions on this bill? Obviously, amendments that need to be that are in the works, so we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 347, and we'll roll over. Ms. Christian, when do you expect those amendments to be available?
Meeting again with Legislative Council after this, after House Judiciary adjourns.
The question is whether we should be re-noticing for a future work session or whether we could roll it over till tomorrow.
I couldn't commit for Legislative Council. If I could make a suggestion.
Let's roll it over.
We can not hear it until the
Okay. We will then roll over until tomorrow, the work session on Senate Bill 347. It may not actually happen on that day, but so that we don't have to re-notice for 48 hours. And down to the point where we have to pay attention to these kinds of timing issues. We'll go next to Senate Bill 1017A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1017A. Senator Burdick.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1017A provides civil and criminal immunity for public and private officials who elect, the reporting is not mandatory, but who elect to report aggravated animal abuse. Senate Bill 1017A relates to the reporting of the crime of aggravated animal abuse and the link between animal abuse and child abuse, i.e., studies suggest that persons who abuse animals are highly likely to also abuse children. Present ORS 167.322 details the Class C felony of aggravated animal abuse. This offense involves either the malicious killing or intentional torture of an animal. Under ORS 686.455, a veterinarian is required to report suspected aggravated animal abuse to a law enforcement agency anytime the vet has either come into contact with the animal or come into contact with the person suspected of committing the abuse. The law provides civil and criminal immunity for any vet who in good faith makes such a report. Senate Bill 1017A expands the class of persons who can report such suspected abuse without fear of lawsuits or prosecution from merely vets to also include any public or private official. However, there is one very significant distinction. Vet reporting of aggravated animal abuse is mandatory, but these public or private officials, their reporting is purely discretionary. If the official chooses to report, then the official does not face litigation. Nothing happens to the official for declining to report. The term public or private official in Senate Bill 1017A mirrors the definition of public or private official in existing Oregon law, ORS 419B005. That's the child abuse reporting statute. It includes, in part, physicians, dentists, school employees, peace officers, clergy, social workers, firefighters, and members of the legislature. This class of persons presently has the mandatory child abuse reporting obligation under ORS 419. An official's failure to report child abuse is a Class A violation. But again, there is no penalty under Senate Bill 1017A for officials who choose not to report aggravated animal abuse.
Thank you, Council. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenny Burdick, and I represent the people of Senate District 18. Animal abuse is a very important issue for me, and I was here in this committee just last week talking about one animal abuse bill. But Senate Bill 1017 is actually about child abuse as opposed to just strictly about animal abuse. Senate Bill 1017, I got the idea for this legislation a couple of years ago because I'm on the mailing list for a national group of prosecutors that specialize in child abuse issues, and perhaps some of you are on that same mailing list. And this one, two editions of this newsletter focused on the fact that children sometimes are very reluctant to report their own abuse. And so people who are suspicious that they may be abused sometimes really can't get it out of the child, like a teacher, for example. But this article concluded also that children sometimes who are not able to talk about their own abuse are able to talk about the abuse of the family pet. And I think that, and those of us on judiciary for a long time certainly know that the link between child abuse and domestic violence and animal abuse is well established. In fact, 85% of battered women report that their pets have been beaten, threatened, or killed by their partners. So Senate Bill 1017 is actually a mechanism to encourage and allow people who can learn about abuse, aggravated animal abuse in a family setting, specifically regarding children, and can report that without having to fear any legal repercussions. They're not required to report it, but if they do report it in good faith, then they are protected from liability for making that report. And this is the sort of thing we've had so many tragic cases in Oregon where a child abuse was not totally identified it as being as serious as it was, and sometimes we've had some tragic outcomes. Senate Bill 1017 will provide just another little information point for people who want to use it without fear of liability to themselves, and perhaps in some cases that will be the one piece of information that results in a full investigation versus letting it pass. This is violence against animals in its own right is a very serious thing and should be reported. But Senate Bill 1017 is specifically aimed at the link between child abuse and animal abuse. So I urge your support for this bill.
Very good. Any questions for Senator Burdick? Senator Krieger.
Senator, was there any opposition to the bill? How did your committee, did they vote?
voted out unanimously, do you remember? Or?
We had some no votes on the committee on the bill. I can't remember whether Senator Cruz was present that day, but Senator Beyer has pretty consistently voted against anything in this subject area, and indeed voted against this, I believe, as I recall. But the support on the floor was bipartisan. We had a lot of Republican support when it got to the Senate floor. And it should also, you know, for people who are from rural areas, this bill has the same protection for animal husbandry practices, animals being taken to slaughter, et cetera. That is not what we are talking about in this bill. We are talking about intentional torture and murder of animals, and that's the definition of aggravated animal abuse. So there's no impact on veterinary practices, animal husbandry, or animals being taken to slaughter.
Any further questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
We have
Mr. Chair, could I add one thing?
Very good.
I just wanted to recognize my legislative assistant, Natasha Dolezal, who's in the audience today, is a graduate of Lewis and Clark Law School, which has a very well-known animal law section, and she is really the one who whipped this bill into shape, and I just wanted that recognition on the record.
That's terrific. We're glad to have your staff advancing our efforts here. We've got Chuck Sparks and Scott Heiser. Why don't we bring both of you up together here?
Thanks very much. Mr. Chair, good morning, members of the committee. Scott Heiser, former prosecutor and current director of the Criminal Justice Program for the Animal Legal Defense Fund in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1017. As you heard from Senator Burdick, this is a bill targeted at child abuse, and it's a step in the right direction, but respectfully, from our perspective, it doesn't quite go far enough. I'm not here to advocate for additional changes or amendments at this point in time. It is a good step in the right direction. There is room for improvement down the road, but this is a good bill, and I would urge the committee's support of this bill. As a former prosecutor, I can tell you that I have seen time and time again the exact scenario played out, and as described by Senator Burdick, where children are reluctant to disclose the physical abuse of themselves or a sibling, but they will talk about a situation where their pet or their neighbor's pet has been seriously injured or tortured. So with that, I'll turn it over.
Very good. Mr. Sparks.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, I'm Chuck Sparks. I'm with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I've been there 21 years, and I've spent 15 years of those 21 prosecuting child abuse. I really have to say that Senator Burdick captured some of the important issues in this bill very well, and I won't try to recover that, but I will tell the chair and members of the committee that in my 15 years and hundreds, if not more, child abuse cases, I can tell the committee that the coincidence of child abuse and animal abuse is extremely high, that when you have the animals in the home being used as a proxy for the children, which is often true, the animals can be used by an abusive individual in the home to hurt the child emotionally. The child will be intimidated or simply heartbroken by what the person is doing to the animal to hurt the child. And if there is a better bellwether of the children's welfare in the home, I'm hard-pressed to find it. If you learn that the animals in the home are being hurt, and aggravated animal abuse obviously is more than just being hurt, it's killed or tortured. If you learn that animals are being killed or tortured, pets are being killed or tortured, you have to be very concerned with the strong likelihood that the children in the home are at high risk, as well as any partner, spouse, or other adult member of the particularly vulnerable adult member of the household, which would include elderly or infirm or disabled members of the household. Obviously, this bill is permissive in nature. It does not require the reporting. I think that point has been emphasized repeatedly. Another interesting aspect of this bill, in my years of prosecuting child abuse, not only have I seen people who have hurt pets and then also hurt the child, so I end up with a prosecution involving aggravated animal abuse and child abuse. You also have situations where people who own particular types of animals that can be trained to attack can and have. I have had cases where they have trained the animal to become very dangerous, and by the cruelty at times inflicted upon that animal in their minds to make it an even more effective attack or defense animal, they make the animal so dangerous that not only are they committing abuse against the animal, but they're making the animal sort of an unchecked weapon inside the home that can hurt the child. And I've had cases where children were hurt, in one case in particular, very extremely, by a pit bull who almost killed the 2.5-year-old toddler by grabbing his throat and sort of opening it up. An observation that seems perhaps pertinent here. While it's not included in the bill, I was interested to note that while veterinarians are mandatory reporters of animal abuse, they are not mandatory reporters of child abuse. And it seems to me that since veterinarians have a very unique perspective on these situations that involve animal abuse, and the coincidence of child abuse being, I think, a well-established fact to those of us in the child abuse prosecution realm, it does make sense to me at some point to consider for future legislation that veterinarians become mandatory child abuse reporters, if we're going to make them mandatory animal abuse reporters, and that animal control officers also be included as mandatory child abuse reporters, which they are not now. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have any questions I'd be glad to answer.
Ms. Sparks, Representative Krieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Indicated it was a good bill, and there's room for improvement down the road. Could you tell me what you think those improvements down the road would include?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, yes. In my opinion, sir, expanding the number of animal abuse crimes that were incorporated into this statute to protect those who report. Right now, the only protection that I would enjoy or you would enjoy on a report, a mandatory report, would be aggravated animal abuse, which is the intentional killing or torture of an animal. Good public policy might suggest that not actually causing the death of the animal but inflicting serious physical injury, you might want to enjoy that same protection for making that report. So those are the types of things that I'm contemplating as I make that comment.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll hear from Kelly Peterson next.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and committee members. My name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm here today representing the Humane Society of the United States and our 130,000 members and constituents. And I've actually submitted some pretty extensive just written comments. And so rather than repeat what's been said, I just wanted to highlight a few other studies. You know, really in the last 20 years, there's really been a growing body of research that significantly links domestic violence, child abuse, and animal abuse. And just on a personal note, I do a lot of work. I do work with children outside of my work for the Humane Society. And I also encountered that about 3 years ago where there was some extreme violence in the family. But the child was able to talk a little bit about some of the animal abuse that was happening in the family prior to that. So, you know, the Humane Society has a first strike program where we put together and we kind of monitor some of the research that's been done by some of the experts in the field. So for us, we just think, you know, cross-reporting, paying attention to the situations of animals and families is just really one more strategy in kind of intervening early before a potentially, you know, serious family abuse occurs, and we just urge your support for the bill.
Very good. Any questions for Ms. Peterson? Thank you very much. Finally, we'll have a panel of Katie Fast and Jim Welch.
Good Good morning, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau's concerns with the bill are not with the intent, but within the definition of a law enforcement agency, the inclusion of the Humane Society, which might be having a law enforcement division. This will be the first time that this type of law enforcement is put into Oregon statutes. The ORS that is referenced is actually a general authority that the governor uses to commission Humane Society law enforcement agencies. And we have concerns that this is a legislation that first puts these type of entities into the statute. There's actually another bill that is sitting in this committee, Senate Bill 406, that that would set up the program in Oregon. From the Farm Bureau's perspective, that bill is to move forward. This definition and this authority should be added to 406, not handled in a separate bill that first references the Humane Society's law enforcement agencies. So we would request that line 14 and 15 on page 1 is deleted from the legislation, please.
Okay, Mr. Welch. Chair McPherson and committee members, Jim Welch with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and we certainly agree with Farm Bureau on this. In 2003, we had a similar bill that was brought forward that we worked on and did not gain agreement around the table, certainly with our district attorneys and other people concerned about the connection between the violence and abuse you saw between child abuse and animal abuse, and we're not intending to get in front of or in between this effort in any way, but we do have a problem with Section 1 sub D there, and we are also working on Senate Bill 406 and SJR 18, and making sure, I think, working with AFSCME and others, that it is our constitutional law officer within the county, our sheriff's department, that are in control of and making the decision of whether or not we will have any special agents out there. We would much rather, when we have our members practicing, certainly good pet management at their home and also good animal husbandry, those individuals, if there's a problem, if they are in any way indicated in some sort of a animal crime, that it is our sheriff's department in uniform, are those who they will endorse or officially allow to come on your property, and they will probably be in a sheriff's department uniform also. Those are those that will be accepted coming on the property when there's a problem. I think there's another problem within the bill, and that's in Section 2. We think that the sub 3, public or private official who sets in good faith and has reasonable grounds for making a report or suspected aggravated animal abuse under this section is not liable in any civil or criminal proceeding brought as a result of making the report. The first part isn't so bad, but not liable. I'm not sure we want to put that in statute here. I think that they're liable for the things they bring forward, no matter, you know, what on an official basis that could run over into an agenda on a personal basis. We're kind of concerned about that language there also, but not with the intent of this bill at all. And Chair McPherson, I appreciate you allowing us to give testimony.
Thank you. So I need to understand the relationship between this language on lines 14 and 15 and the separate bill, Senate Bill 406. I'm sort of generally aware of that bill and what it does, but is it what creates the authorization under ORS
131.805? Chair McPherson, ORS 131805 is actually a general authorization statute that the governor currently uses to move forward and commission humane officers. What Senate Bill 406 does is it sets up, instead of using that general authorization, it sets up the program in statute. And both of our associations, along with some others, have some concerns, and that's another issue with 406, and have some proposed amendments for that bill. But our concern today with 1017 is that this legislation is actually recognizing those officers currently into the statute as law enforcement divisions without other other authorizing statute specific to those positions.
But it would seem as though the concern is really not directed at the substance of this bill. It's the fact that it refers to a function that you folks in your opposition to Senate Bill 406, and perhaps opposition to even the use of 131.805 to authorize these agents, think that that's not a function that ought to be going on. But
And Representative McPherson, that is correct. And our concerns is that this is another route to put these entities into the statute without their own authorizing statutes moving forward.
Okay. And the purpose of the reference to law enforcement agency, that's who the public or private official would report the observation of aggravated animal abuse to, right?
Yes.
So, okay. Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if this particular issue that you're raising about the language on lines 14 and 15 was addressed in the Senate.
Representative McPherson and Bonamici, we did not become aware. We followed the bill in the Senate, but not closely. It wasn't until it moved over to the House and we saw that this piece was added that the Farm Bureau became concerned with the legislation.
Representative Krieger.
I'd have some real concerns. If you're going to have a definition in here of a non-governmental agency, which is a humane society, which isn't a branch of any county, city, or state government, being designated and then as having that type of authority, and then on top of that, I'm not even certain what training these people get as far as do they carry guns and all this. We went into a bill with that last time, and that might be in 406, and I'm not going to go there.
Okay. Mr. Welsh, you raised, I think, another issue, and I didn't get it down in my notes. It was
Section 2, sub 3. The last portion of that was a liability issue here and codifying that. Not sure how appropriate that is.
Right. Counsel has advised me that this parallels the language of the existing statute on child abuse reporting.
Okay.
So that, in effect, one could, the public or private official who observes what they think is abuse and makes a report, even if it was just a misunderstanding of a situation that was entirely innocent, they wouldn't have any exposure. So just be creating a parallel protection under this statute here.
Mr. Chair, it's ORS 419B.025 is the statute that references that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisdom.
Thank you. I think we're all concerned about child abuse. And in this bill, however, I don't see any way that they get together. I don't see the connection, the reporting. I don't see anything in here that tells anyone that notices animal abuse that you should be aware that there's a connection and how you report that and how you get it into the child abuse and to the human services arena or the look. There's a lot of things missing here. I mean, it's just the testimony was convincing, I think, that there is a connection, but I don't see that this bill provides that direction of how to do it.
I think what we should do is probably bring back up one of our law enforcement people to fill in that gap. Any other questions or comments that would be related to the input we just got? here. Before you leave the table there, though, Mr. Welsh, was that sort of background on your second point sufficient to resolve the concern?
I think at this point, yes.
Okay.
Chair McPherson, thank you.
Okay, if there are no further questions for these folks, thank you very much. Mr. Sparks, I wonder if you could come and respond to the question that Representative Wisner raised.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, Vice Chair Wisner. The question, as I understand it, is, once again, Chuck Sparks, Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. As I understand it, is okay, there's a connection between child abuse and animal abuse, but what does this report do? What does this process do to make sure that the child abuse component is addressed? And what happens under Section 4 of the Act, or of the bill, is that the law enforcement agency receiving the report of suspected aggravated animal abuse shall investigate the nature and cause of the suspected aggravated animal abuse. And what happens then, of course, is with a law enforcement agency conducting an investigation, if there is associated child abuse, law enforcement officers are, of course, mandatory child abuse reporters, and they are likely, obviously, if they become aware of it, of child abuse that is occurring at the same time, they will, in the course of their investigation, if they discover that, then they can carry the investigation forward. It is not a guarantee that if there is a coincidence of child abuse and animal abuse, that child abuse will be discovered during an animal abuse investigation. But the odds are higher, obviously, if you get animal, if you have animal abuse, aggravated animal abuse, that law enforcement is going to at least be exposed to the family, and the potential for reporting will, potential for identification and reporting by these law enforcement officers, who are also mandatory child abuse reporters, that they will then investigate the child abuse component under 419B, which is what they're required to do. It's I think a well known fact in the law enforcement community that if you have the animals being hurt in the home, that a police officer, from someone who's a rookie all the way up the chain to someone who is a more advanced and experienced investigator, is going to be at least looking at the welfare of the children in the home. That doesn't entitle them to create some sort of invasive, all-consuming investigation, but the link is to the law enforcement agency, and that increases the likelihood of discovery.
Thank you for those comments. But, I mean, if I'm looking at this bill as a citizen or even one of these reporters, I'd like to see, whereas it's proven that abuse of animals has a connection to child abuse or something. That doesn't say anything in here about this, in this bill, about the connection that you're trying to make. And I think, and I'll have to go research more, but I'm assuming that connection is with domestic pets. It's not talking about farm animals.
That's all of the anecdotal evidence that I'm familiar with, and the literature that I'm familiar with, is relating to domestic pets. That's exactly right. And certainly, in my view, there is no problem with adding that language. It would certainly make sense to add something that is a sort of a cautionary note at the beginning. This is why we're doing it. This is the purpose of our making this connection.
And I think, Mr. Chair, that would, we narrow it to domestic pets abuse or something, the connection or something here.
I'm guessing that there's probably no statutory distinction or no definition of what is a domestic pet as compared to a...
Correct, and obviously we would be concerned if somebody were, being cruel to, would a horse be a domestic pet, or would a horse be something else, just a livestock? And I can't really help the committee with that distinction. I can tell the committee that if someone is hurting an animal, defenseless and under their control, they are more likely to hurt a child, a spouse, partner, or an elderly or disabled person who is within their range of control.
Thank you. There are no further questions, and thank you, Mr. Sparks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Committee, what I suggest we do in this bill is that since the one point of conflict in the presentations we heard relates to the
reference to humane agents, society agents, that we close the public hearing and roll this bill over to the time when we will be hearing testimony on the other bill that creates specific statutory authority on humane agents, and then whether there's a need to amend this bill may be more apparent to us based on that input.
Sure, I'd still like to see the, why are we doing this? And it's because of domestic child abuse.
And I would urge those who are presenting and hearing that concern to have conversations with Representative Wisnett to give that input. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1017. We'll now go back to the top of our agenda and resume the public hearings that we were not able to finish on the first couple of bills. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 331A. Why don't you remind us about this bill, Council Stanford?
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 331A relates to the creation of a Class B felony of organized retail theft. Again, this present Oregon law divides most theft offenses by dollar value. First degree theft is a Class C felony and it applies for stolen items valued at or over $750. Second degree theft is a Class A misdemeanor. It's for stolen items valued between $50 and $750. And then third degree theft is a Class C misdemeanor and it's for what's left beneath $50 or less than $50. There's also aggravated first-degree theft, a Class B felony, which applies for stolen items in a single or aggregate transaction at $10,000 or higher. Retail merchants have recently reported organized thefts involving multiple persons who are often involved with drug trade or methamphetamine, in which they steal various items from stores with the purpose of later reselling these items on eBay, Craigslist, flea markets, etc. This is a way of financing their drug operations. And persons hit multiple stores and acting in concert together and then sell the items on the secondary market. Senate Bill 331A creates the new crime of organized retail theft to capture this conduct and to punish it at the felony level. To be guilty of organized retail theft, the state must establish that, one, the person stole merchandise, two, it was from a mercantile establishment, three, the person acted in concert with another person, four, the aggregate value of the merchandise within a 90-day period exceeds $5,000. Senate Bill 331A also places the crime of organized retail theft within Oregon's Racketeer Influence and Corrupt Organizations, otherwise known as RICO statute. And there was a similar bill passed in Washington, I believe, in 05 or 06, that it's Washington Code 9A.56.350 dealing with organized retail theft.
Thank you, Council. Rob Bavette.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Rob Bovette here on behalf of the Governor's Meth Task Force, which urges you to pass this bill. Just very briefly, I think you heard testimony about this bill from the retail folks on Friday. The Washington bill referenced by council is House Bill 2704, which passed in 2006. It basically created the enhanced crime if there was $1,500 in aggregate thefts over 180 days. As Senate Bill 331 was originally introduced on the Senate side, it was very similar. It would have created enhanced crime for $1,000 of aggregate theft over 180 days. After hearing some concerns from the folks that I think you're going to be hearing from in a moment, as well as from Senator Brzezinski, we agreed to adjust the bill to make it what it is today, which is $5,000 over 90 days to make sure we didn't capture lower-level offenders. I think that does place us at some disadvantage by comparison to the state of Washington, but I think the bill is still a real good bill that needs to pass for the reasons you heard on Friday. Doesn't have a fiscal impact statement. Criminal Justice Commission analyzed it, so again, I think we're really trying to tackle something that's evolved as part of our ongoing efforts to deal with and address the meth epidemic. Would strongly encourage you to pass this bill. It passed unanimously on the Senate side, 29 yes votes and one excused. Happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Mr. Bovette?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Washington State's 1,000, how many days for the accumulation?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's actually $1,500 over 180 days is what the Washington law currently provides.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
You may.
Well, you know, thank you for your comments. I mean, I agree with you. That doesn't, you know, we're trying to prevent meth use and to stop this, and I'm disappointed that we went with that, you know, numbers that we did. And maybe we can look at it again in the future. Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, welcome back, Mr. Vervette. You mentioned something about not having a fiscal, and I wonder why, if it were having a 10 years imprisonment, if there's some reason why there's no fiscal, other than the fact that maybe these people were going to get caught and prosecuted anyway under a different statute.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's exactly the reason why a Criminal Justice Commission came up with that. Keep in mind, this bill is really designed to capture those crimes that really are more than shoplifting, but less than a full federal case or a RICO case, and so that's what's being targeted. So the idea is that we're capturing people that are going to be in the system. They're just going to be treated, hopefully, a little bit differently and a little bit more aggressively through, you know, the attention of law enforcement.
Thank you.
Very good. Mr. Vervette, thank you very much, and for coming at a distance to present to our committee again. Okay, Ann Christian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ann Christian, and I represent the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And let me say that we did appreciate being involved in the work group with Senator Przanski and the proponents of this bill. And we don't, as an organization, certainly support organized theft or any organized crime. Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers' primary concern about this bill continues to be the fact that there is an existing statute called RICO, racketeering, and that statute provides for this type of organized effort that you heard about on Friday. The proponents indicate that that is a difficult statute to prosecute under, and I do know that it is rarely used. I know in the early 90s or mid-90s it was used in Portland for gang organized activity. And I just continue to wonder and be concerned that the racketeering statute won't be used in these types of egregious situations, especially for what I would call the kingpin, not the people who are addicted to meth, who actually should be offered drug treatment as a part of drug court. But my concern is primarily for that individual who's abusing, using these individuals to go out and steal all of this retail merchandise, and then the kingpin is the one who benefits from that financially. And the RICO statute does provide one thing that current criminal statutes, even this new crime in Senate Bill 331, doesn't offer, which under RICO, the court on conviction can order a fine that is three times the gross value of the financial gain or the loss. To me, an individual who is taking advantage of people on meth or other drugs to rip off, if you will, these retail establishments ought to be prosecuted under RICO. We had some of the same concerns that ACLU, Ms. Meyer, will voice, but our primary one was that there is an existing law that would address the criminal activity of the kingpins, and for those who are the minions or whatever term we want to use, existing law does provide a Class C felony for people who rip off retail establishments or rip off you and me in an amount that exceeds $750, so $750 up to $10,000. So thank you, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Let's hear from Ms. Meyer, and then we'll see if there are any questions.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon, here today in opposition to Senate Bill 331. It is correct that there was some meeting or, quote, work group that was pulled together, and as you know from past testimony and past bills, we've often been able to come to some resolution when we all sit down and meet and come back with a bill that we're all comfortable with. This is not the case.
just so that there's no, for purposes of clarity, not for purposes of complaint, when it did come back to the judiciary, it just came back for a work session and there was no opportunity for us to testify. Otherwise, I would have been making it more clear over there, our opposition even to the amended bill. The testimony you heard on Friday was about thousands and thousands of dollars being stolen every day. And 8 to 10 stores hit. And like Ms. Christian, and I want to make it crystal clear, these people need to be prosecuted. It's just our position that the tools and the level of punishment already exists. And what we're doing is creating a special law for mercantile establishments different than anyone else. So you heard testimony that they're only prosecuting folks for misdemeanors, or I heard petty shoplifting, and that there's really nothing to allow them to target people at the higher level. You heard an example of a person who was arrested for stealing wine, I think at $1,800 to $2,500 a shot, and prosecuted at, quote, petty shoplifting, and the need to separate this from petty crimes. But when I look at the law and the code under theft, and so those are misdemeanors, but we already have felony charges available for these kinds of crimes. So theft one for $750 to $10,000 at either any one time or aggregate is already a C felony. So we have that covered. But indeed, if they go over $10,000, it can be a B felony. So the scheme is already there, layering it up, ratcheting up the penalty as the amount. What this appears to do is create a special statute for merchants, leaving maybe the rest of us out of this enhanced type of penalty for other kinds of property crimes. I've also heard in previous conversations about this and somewhat a little bit about giving it prosecutors. I think Mr. Brovett said something about prosecutors being more aggressive. The problem is that prosecutors and the DAs are not going after these folks. The solution isn't simply to ratchet up the crime to increase the attention to this activity and making it either easier to prosecute or suggesting that it should be special. Prosecutors need to be going after these folks already. They certainly have the tools already and the punishment that fits the crime already. So we urge you not to add this new additional layer that doesn't seem to make sense within the careful scheme already developed in the criminal code. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Although when it comes to the RICO stuff, I will defer to Ms. Christian as the expert over me.
I guess maybe the overriding question is it just that it's unnecessary, or is there some affirmative problem that would be created by developing this additional tool?
Mr. Chair, I would say it's simply one of the issues that we try to keep a handle on proportionality. So if an individual, you know, rounds up the same individuals who are addicted to meth and they commit home burglaries and wind up taking, you know, heirlooms and all this merchandise, or not merchandise, from my home and from Andrea's home and from your home in an amount that exceeds $5,000, that person would be prosecuted for a Class C felony rather than a B felony.
Because under current law, it's a C felony, but under this, if this the same activity occurred to the business sector, just the exact same, except they rounded up the watches and all those things at the stores, then they would be subject to a B felony. It's a serious concern to us when we think the tools are available and we start kind of doing this very piecemeal. I think, yes, there's a problem, and I think these people should be prosecuted, and I think, as Ms. Christian said, you know, the meth folks, maybe a B felony or a C felony isn't the right way. It's the kingpin and others, so.
Okay. Representative Wisner,
quick question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Christian said this is against the establishment or whatever. It's also against us. They steal from us. It drives our cost up. It helps, you know, the overall problem. So, and I was wondering, have you looked at the Washington state law? Do you think they've made a mistake? Because know, much smaller threshold. And then another question is, does the state of Idaho have a similar bill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, I'll answer the question that I have the most ready answer to. I did look at the Washington State statute after the work group meeting is when I looked at it, and I am a resident of Washington, so I can speak with some authority that I do think that the state of Washington should have taken the approach that we're suggesting, which is if there's a need to amend the theft laws, amend them up. You may recall, without going too much on a tangent, that Oregon criminal defense lawyers had a bill that did adjust the theft amounts. And that's what, I don't know all the details about the Washington state law and what they considered and all that, but that's what, as a resident, even a resident of Washington state, I would have hoped they would have done. I do not know about Idaho. Do have a concern that people will come over to Vancouver and create more retail theft. And just as the home, just as the retail establishments hurt us because the prices go up, with my analogy to the home burglaries, the number of burglaries that occur, I think, are related to increase in insurance rates. So, thank you.
Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron.
It sounded like some of the objection was that we were pulling in a special class of mercantile establishments. Is that what I heard? Would you be less objective if we just changed that to mercantile establishments and private burglaries? I mean, so that we brought in anybody who was doing this type of thing in 90 days and $5,000, and it included your private home, would that be something we could do?
Mr. Chair and Representative Cameron, that's certainly something I'd like to talk about and think about. And it would help with the proportionality issue. And I'd have to think about other circumstances where thefts are occurring. Theft one already excludes motor vehicles. We've got other statutes that deal with theft of motor vehicles, so we don't have to be concerned about that. That might help, in fact. It really would be an amendment to the existing statutory scheme for theft. So we currently have theft three, which I believe is a C misdemeanor, the least serious. Theft 2, which is a Class A misdemeanor. We currently have theft 1, right, which is a C felony, mm-hmm. and aggravated theft 1. So I think we'd be creating another level of theft.
Chairman McPherson, Representative Cameron, sensibly, I would prefer, my reasons would prefer that we work within the context we already have and not start delineating out where the theft occurred. I mean, theft to anyone affects not only the community, but the individual, and in an extreme detrimental manner. And one thing about our code, except for motor vehicles, is we don't start picking and choosing. Where I really do think the problem going on here, in part from the testimonies that I've heard, is that these folks aren't being prosecuted as aggressively as they can, that the tools are available, the high sentences are available. And I don't know why someone who's caught stealing this kind of money is charged with, quote, petty shoplifting. Yeah. That, you have to go to the issue of resources and DAs, not changing the statute. So if we're going to do that, I'd rather do that wholesale. I'd rather do that during the interim, that we look at things. We're always very concerned when we start amending piecemeal our criminal code, both in the sentencing and the underlying crimes. And it's something that needs to be looked at again. I think it was the criminal commission was 20, 30 years ago. It's time to start looking at this holistically.
Mr. Chair, I think we heard testimony on Friday that the reason they're prosecuted as minor crimes is because you can't tie the theft in this location to the theft in this location under existing statutes, so that's why they're prosecuted that way, and that's what this bill does, is allow us to tie those rings together. And I just wanted to make sure that if the objection was because it doesn't tie enough organized crime together, maybe we want to make sure we bring some more organized crime in under the bill. But I don't want to hold this bill up to do that today.
I heard on the radio this morning come in about our session and what we're doing, and you know, we've talked about stealing metal and how that contributes to the meth problem. We did a great job last session with the drugs, you know, making prescription drugs and things like that. I mean, this is another step. Let's look at the big picture. We're looking at trying to stop meth use, which is a terrible thing in our society and causing us terrible amounts of family distress and financial stress, and this is another tool against meth. I think that's how we should look at it, meth abuse.
Sure. Representative Krieger. Appreciate the conversations we've had, but I look at this a little bit different. It came about as a way of being much more efficient at what they do. It's not like an individual goes and steals a pack of cigarettes. These people are organized gangs. We heard that they have spotters, people that actually block a door. So they're very well organized, and they become very, very efficient, and they can steal a lot of product quick. And you and I are all paying for it when we go in there. It's different today than it was 5 years ago with these type of people.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I don't disagree with either Representative Wisnett or Representative Krieger, and our, as I indicated, our primary concern is that there is an existing statute called racketeering, which is much, it's a Class A felony that is on the books that can be used for at least the kingpins and some of the minions.
Okay. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a clarification. Our staff measure summary talks about how some of these people intentionally keep the value of what they steal on a particular store on a particular day below $750 so they can stay as a misdemeanor. So how, under existing law, can those be tied together if they keep the value below knowing that it's only a misdemeanor at one store and then the next day they go to another store? Under existing law, can those be tied together if it's under RICO or under some other? Can they be grouped together? Because you're saying that the tools are there, and there's people on Friday said that they don't have the tools because of that reason.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bonamici, clearly for aggravated theft, which is the existing Class B felony, there is a provision that the value of the property in a single or aggregate transaction is $10,000 or more. And I have to plead ignorance, quite frankly. Well, I'm sorry, theft in the third degree, which is the Class C misdemeanor. It's the least serious. Provides 164043, a person commits a crime of theft in the third degree if by means other than extortion the person commits the theft and the total value of the property in a single or an aggregate transaction is under $50. And I'm looking, and there's similar language for theft in the second degree and theft in the first degree. So I don't know currently why they can't aggregate these little petty thefts.
Counselor?
Different days.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici. I can address a couple of points. One, if we want to talk more specifically about the RICO statute and what it requires, or just this aggregation of it, things happening multiple times.
Actually, if I could break in at this point, we've got barely a little more than half an hour before we have to be on the floor, and we've got several other bills that are set for hearing today. But because this is getting complicated, what I was going to suggest is that we roll this forward. I think we've gotten all the input that we would in public hearing, and we roll this forward into tomorrow, and then maybe we could refine these issues further, and then we could, for people who've come out of their way to hear it, to present on other bills.
I would be willing to move it forward, Mr. Chair.
Well, I would be too, but I just, if we needed more input in order to make the committee feel settled about where they were, I didn't.
I'm comfortable now. It's up to the other members.
I just wanted clarification on whether they can aggregate, because that was the big concern, is that people are going into one store and keeping what they steal below a certain level and then going to another store. Can those be combined under existing law?
Representative Bonamici, sometimes. Sometimes is the answer. It depends on, it is difficult. In my experience, it's difficult. Part of the problem is logistics, because they steal something at Fred Meyer in Multnomah County up on Lombard, and then they go out to Clackamas County and do something different. Well, out in Clackamas County, it's a different police force that responds. It's a different DA that's handling it, and to connect the two is sometimes quite difficult to do. That's one problem that you have. It's just the logistics of being able to do it. There are certain evidentiary requirements, common practice, procedures, similar incidents in nature. You know, it's not impossible, but it's difficult, I guess, is the short answer.
Representative Flores, briefly.
Yeah, I'm supportive of the concept of this bill. I think we do need to have some further discussion, and if it's difficult because of jurisdictional issues, how will this bill be any different? Because so I think the discussion needs to be a little more fully vetted.
A quick response to that, Representative Flores, is I would say with this bill, the DA's offices would be more cognizant of you know, what's going on with this person and running, making sure that if you have persons involved in theft, that you're running a statewide led search on everybody before you're charging them to see what else is going on with the person. You'd be more aware of that than what you presently are.
Do people have all the input they need on this bill and it's ready to move, or should we roll it over so they can reflect on what we've heard?
Based upon the Senate and another tool against meth, I'm very comfortable, Mr. Chair.
Anybody feel like they need more time to consider input? Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 331A and open a work session on Senate Bill 331A.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 331A to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves Senate Bill 331A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
One more question. Sorry. Counsel, under existing law, could this type of behavior already be considered under the RICO statute? Because it says it's adding it to the RICO, but it sounds like something that it is organized, and it sounds like it would already be RICO.
Representative Bonamici, I just closed the book on my definition of RICO that I was going to read. RICO is a tool that exists right now in Oregon law and could potentially cover this. The evidence, it is a Class A felony. It is, for whatever reason, and I can touch on it briefly, rarely if ever utilized in Oregon. The feds do it, perhaps because they have more resources to go in and conduct more thorough investigations than what we have. I have, personally, in my experience as a prosecutor, I tried to encourage Multnomah County to prosecute some drug kingpin types that I wanted to handle under Oregon RICO, and I don't know if I'm selling out Multnomah County on the record, but the response was, no, we don't have the time, energy to do this. And part of it is what you have to prove. Could this conduct potentially be covered there? Yes, absolutely. But the thoroughness of the investigation, the pattern and practice, the connections between the various incidents, and then showing the financial benefit to the kingpins is more what RICO. I just don't know that it's utilized in Oregon ever. I could be wrong about that, but I know I've met with total resistance in Multnomah County when I've tried to.
Thank you. And just one brief comment before we proceed. If everybody agrees that this is a very serious problem, but if it's a problem because of lack of judicial resources and lack of money to go after these and lack of funding for our prosecutors, then let's fix that.
And I didn't have a copy myself. Well, it may be useful for the committee to, if they don't have copies of the fiscal analysis that said that the Criminal Justice Commission determined there would not be an increase in prison beds as a result.
That's right. That's right.
I think I gave my only copy. Just wanted to get that on the record that we have that input. Not sure that I...
Yeah,
there we are.
There is a fiscal analysis of 331A that, in short, the fiscal impact of this bill is indeterminate. It is not possible to accurately predict the number of new cases that may be charged under this bill. Under current law, these activities can be charged as Theft 1 or under Oregon's RICO. In addition to crime, let's see. It is not clear whether district attorneys would choose to utilize to choose to use organized retail theft law when other options could be available. However, the Criminal Justice Commission does not anticipate a prison bed impact due to this bill. So I think that's the basis for no.
Okay. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Excused.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 331A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer for carrying this?
I will.
Lives in a comp?
There's more meth sold in my neighborhood than most.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 331A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 464A. We are resuming the hearing, and maybe to very briefly remind us what this bill is about, Council.
Thank you, Chair McPherson, members of the committee. Senate Bill 464A relates to the Class C felony of identity or of aggravated identity theft, a Class B felony. Existing law has the Class C felony of identity theft. The elements of this offense are intent to deceive or defraud. You obtain, possess, convert to defendant's own use the personal identification of another. Personal identification includes a broad array of written documents or electronic data. Senate Bill 464A expands this offense by creating aggravated identity theft, a Class B felony. The elements of this offense are basically that you commit the Class C felony of identity theft either 10 or more times in 180 days, 2, you commit identity theft a single time or however much, and the amount of damage is over $10,000 in a 180-day period, or 3, you commit identity theft and this defendant has 10 or more pieces of identification from 10 or more different persons.
Thank you, Counsel. I have Ann Christian signed up. Is there... Let's hear from Ms. Christian, and then we'll hear from Mr. Campbell.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, Ann Christian with Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers, and this will be very brief. We were involved in a really good work group on this bill, and we are in support of Senate Bill 464 and Grost.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Christian? Thank you very much. Mr. Campbell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm here both on behalf of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police and the Governor's Meth Task Force. Really don't have anything to add except for to mention that the Regional Economic Crime Information Center Foundation, these are the folks that worked on this bill, have not been in the building much. They don't have a paid representative. I've been involved on a cursory basis because I am a member of the Governor's Meth Task Force and had a chance to review the bill in that context. And from the standpoint of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, who supports the bill. And so I'm really here on their behalf. I asked them not to come back from Portland up here today just because I knew you had limited time, but I would like to ask the committee to favorably consider this bill. It was strongly supported in the Senate. We'd love to have the support of this committee, and we'd love to have you send it to the floor. And with that, Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Campbell, we had had some indication that there were some questions had been raised offline about the bill that we were going to be getting some input on from Mr. Prinz from the Criminal Justice Commission.
Mr. Chair,
that?
Members of the committee, I believe, and I'm not obviously an expert in charging instruments, I believe that this is another example where things can be charged differently. I think that the strength of the bill, the piece that is of greatest benefit, is the ability to aggregate these cases where you have cases in multiple counties, being able to charge them in a single county, thus reducing the amount of prosecution and defense resources necessary to move these things forward. And so I do think that in terms of aggregated identity theft, currently there was some question about whether some of these could be charged under the repo statute. That I think that's a question that the court will determine and prosecutors will determine as they move forward. But the key is, I think, the aggregation portion of the bill. And again, I'm not an expert on the charging instruments.
Chair McPherson, if I may, but just my what Mr. Campbell said is correct. My understanding from talking to Mr. Prinz was that his concern is that the aggravated identity theft Class B felony would oftentimes actually result in the idea of a lesser sentence for a person, that a person who has 10 or more IDs from 10 or more different persons could be charged with 10 separate counts of identity theft, and even if they had no prior criminal history, could be subject to the, we were talking about RICO a second ago, now we're on REPO, to the repeat property offender statutes. And so you would actually do more time that in that fashion than what you would under this. It was a relatively short conversation with Mr. Prinz, but he had some thoughts or concerns about it, and that was the nature of our conversation.
Committee, given that input, what I'd like to do is to roll over the work session on this bill so we can make sure we chase down that point, make sure that there, whatever concern is resolved, and we can bring it back. So I will. Is there anyone else here who want to present on Senate Bill 464? If not, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 464 and put on the record that a work session on is noticed for automatically rolled over until tomorrow. I'd like to now open public hearings on two bills that we have. Mr. Boss has been very patient about waiting until they come up. Senate Bill 130 and Senate Bill 133. And because he's the only person signed up, I will open a public hearing on both of those bills. Mr. Boss.
Sorry.
Please summarize, Council.
I'll do both bills. Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, first of all, well, both Senate Bill 130A and 133A are products of the Restitution Reform Task Force. First of all, Senate Bill 130A relates to imposing restitution in less than a victim's full economic damages in certain situations. If a defendant is found guilty of a crime, a court may order that the defendant financially compensate any victims of the crime. The present mechanism for compensating a crime victim's economic losses means objectively verifiable monetary losses like medical expenses, funeral costs, lost income, replace damaged property, etc. That's called restitution. A court can only award restitution if the crime victim actually suffered such damages. Theoretically, there could be instances in which a crime victim would agree to take less than the full amount of his or her economic damages, perhaps to effectuate a plea bargain. There is presently no specific statutory authority that permits a court to award less than the full amount of economic damages, nor is there any definition of full amount of victims' economic damages. Senate Bill 130A provides that authority for a court to order less than the full amount, but it requires the written consent of the victim. It applies only to what are called person felonies and not to any non-person felonies or misdemeanors. So, in other words, if there is restitution awarded in a person felony, and the victim wants to accept less than the full amount, written consent is required. That would not be required in non-person felonies or misdemeanors, such as DUI, reckless driving, theft, assault in the fourth degree, etc. That's Senate Bill 130A. Senate Bill 133A relates to disclaimers of property. In 2001, Oregon adopted the Uniform Disclaimer of Property Interest Act. It permits individuals to disclaim, that is, to refuse to take, inheritances for tax or other reasons. In some cases, debtors disclaim inheritances to avoid having to pay their creditors. According to the Oregon Department of Justice, criminals have used the rules governing disclaimers to avoid paying restitution awards. Thus, the inheritances can go to the criminals' families instead of to the crime victims. Senate Bill 133A would bar disclaimers if the purpose or effect of the disclaimer is to prevent the recovery of an award of restitution.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Boss.
Jerry McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fred Boss, Chief Counsel. I am Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice, and I am here to testify in support of both Senate Bill 130A and 133A. I believe that counsel accurately summarized both of these bills. The first bill, Senate Bill 130, allows the little bit of flexibility for the system. It allows for both the court, the prosecutors, and the victims to accept less than the full amount of an award if there is the consent of the victim. If it is a person crime, then that consent must be in writing. If it is other than that, then the consent can be orally. Just allows a little bit of flexibility that the present system doesn't have on its face. So it was more or less a cleanup amendment or a cleanup bill. Certain instances where a victim would may want to accept more than the full amount of restitution would be if For example, a family member of the defendant steps forward and agrees to pay off the or pay the victim 100%, or I mean 50% of their economic loss. The victim can then weigh whether or not they would accept very small payments, perhaps over time, from the actual criminal defendant, or take a lump sum for less than a full amount of money from the relative of the defendant. That's a very real life example that happens every day. This would allow the flexibility for those people to take that if they wished. Shall I move to 133 also?
Actually, why don't we take it bill by bill here, Representative Krieger.
Chair, is there any type of circumstance that you've experienced where the victim would be pressured into this for some other reason around the case?
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, I believe that there is always the opportunity for that, and however, the consent of the victim, that's why we really wanted to make sure that the victim had to consent to any form of reduction in this payment amount. The going back a few sessions, the reason the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force implemented as some corrections in the restitution system was essentially to make restitution, take it kind of, put more of a control of restitution with the victim. So it mandated the award of full amount of the restitution. Up to that point, there was a potential for a bargaining of a lowering restitution or actually doing away with restitution or a plea bargain. And this is a plea bargain for the amount of time to be served. We put protections into place, and this we found that perhaps it was a little too rigid, and this gives a little more flexibility for the system.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Boss. I was hoping you'd tell us a story or give us some example about the policy reasons why we should support this bill, and you did talk about the relative who would pay, but I'm a little confused, I guess, about why under current law the relative couldn't just pay the judgment of the defendant. I mean, why would you need to say the judgment could be for less in order for the relative to pay? If the relative is willing to pay, can't the relative just pay the judgment?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Bonamici, often the relative may not have 100% of the amount due. It just gives a little bit more flexibility for the system. It also gives an incentive for a full payment, for example, as opposed to a payment over time, which is allowed under the present system. So if the criminal defendant is unemployed or going to a period of incarceration, they would be unable to pay or only be able to pay at $50 a month on a $100,000 bet or debt. A third party, and I just for example a relative, but it could be any third party, could make an arrangement where they could pay less than the full amount, give an incentive for a payment of a lump sum, and it allows the victim to have the choice.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Voss, could you just confirm for the record Crime Victims United was part of the task force and they supported this?
Chair McPherson, Vice Chair Wisnett, Crime Victims United is part of the task force, and they were in concurrence in all of our packages moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. For committee counsel, the floor vote was not that strong, and I was wondering what did we miss here? That seems like a pretty good bill for people, and the floor vote was closer. And was there anything in the committee hearing that how that vote went?
Surprising. There were 10 noes on the Senate floor about this bill.
Representative Wisnett, I actually can't respond to that as to what
about
exactly.
Committee vote? What was the committee vote?
Committee vote was.
I don't know that we have that information.
I don't know that I recall.
3-2.
What it was. 3-2. It was 3-2.
No
remember what their objection or what? I mean, I don't see.
If Mr. Boss can correct me, but if I recall, I'm thinking Senator Beyer in the committee asking why this is necessary. Isn't it? Can't we do that? This already? Doesn't this happen already? Isn't this just another step, like a procedural step that's required? There may have been some discussion. There may have been some discussion about what exactly full measure of economic damages means. How is that determined? I don't recall.
I realize you'd be speaking for people who yeah. You don't agree with, who are not in the room, Mr. Boss, but to the best we have. But what you can you shed any light on this?
Chairman McPherson, quite honestly, I don't remember. I remember Senator Beyer did have difficulty with it, and quite honestly, I don't remember the problems that he had.
I mean, Mr. Bob, if it's appropriate, just one question. Like, how play this out for a second, and let's say that there's a person felony, there's an assault three or something where the victim has been injured and has medical expenses. And there's a plea deal that's worked out with some sort of restitution award. Is it, how do you believe this would happen if this bill becomes law? In practice, the judge would have to make a determination, what is your full amount of economic damages, and if this, to have a hearing on that issue, and if it's any less than the full amount, then to require the written consent, how would this play out?
Chairman McPherson, counsel, that is how we envision it playing out. Currently, there is a hearing to determine the amount of restitution, and currently the victim or the district attorney comes forward and presents medical bills, the loss of the vehicle, or whatever there is as far as concrete evidence of economic loss. In this circumstance, at that hearing, it's how we envision it, at that hearing, the prosecution would say, in addition, that the victim intends to take less than that full amount in order, because of essentially a plea bargain, or because they can put on the record the circumstances, and at that time there'll be a determination that the economic damages are $100,000. The victim has decided that they would like a judgment in the amount of $50,000, and here's the written consent. The reason that we worked through why it is an amended version is that in discussions that we had, that the thought was that if we in the original bill we required written consent of the victim all the time. However, the system just doesn't work that way, and with crimes that are misdemeanors or lesser felonies. In order to obtain the written consent of the victim every time, it would just slow down the whole judicial system. So we amended the current bill so that in those very serious crimes, we require written consent of the victim. However, in the lesser crimes, I know all crime is bad, but in the crimes that were not person felony crimes, then the oral consent of the victim would be sufficient. And in those circumstances, I assume the district attorney would say, here's the proof of the damages. We're going to order request a judgment for less than the full amount, and I have personally spoken with the victim, and they consent.
Chairman McPherson, if I'm having prosecuted, handling those cases, usually where you have 100 cases on the docket, and the way it's presented is just if there's a plea deal and the defendant wants to take it on the day of call, you call the victim by phone, victim's at work, victim doesn't want to be inconvenienced coming down, and you hopefully have information in the file already about what the restitution amount they're requesting is, or you call them and say, what do you want, what do you need, what are you out of pocket, what makes you whole, $5,000, $10,000, defense, is that okay? Yep. And you put it into the plea agreement, and the judge just says, that's all. That's all they do. There isn't the inquiry about, is this the full amount or anything? It's just what makes the victim happy. And that's what the DA is trying to do.
Yeah, committee, I suspect that this, that probably the opposition was just a sense that we were being too soft on wrongdoers. But if the victim is in the driver's seat, that seemed like a valid concern to me. We're running short on time, so why don't we get Mr. Boss's input on Senate Bill 133, which we're already in public hearing on, and then we can consider to see if we have time to work both these bills.
Jim McPherson, members of the committee. My name is Fred Boss. I'm Chief Counsel of the Civil Enforcement Division of the Oregon Department of Justice. Senate Bill 133A also comes from the Attorney General's Restitution Reform Task Force, and it is driven by an example or by an actual circumstance in which a prisoner was a relative died, and the prisoner was to receive an inheritance. The prisoner owed a significant restitution judgment to his victim. The prisoner, in order to, for whatever motivation, but we assume to spite the victim, disclaimed his inheritance. The entire inheritance went to the victim's sister, and we don't know what happened after that point. But the victim was denied payment of the restitution judgment. Disclaimers of inheritance are a tax planning tools that estate planning attorneys do use in Oregon, and it has a legitimate use in order not to have tax consequences for heirs. However, the Restitution Reform Task Force felt that this was not an appropriate use of a disclaimer. So the bill is that if you are, if the result of the disclaimer is that you would not, it is to avoid a restitution judgment, that is improper. And there are other instances in Oregon law that prohibit the use of a disclaimer. If you owe money because of Medicaid fraud and you owed money to, and you could receive an inheritance that would make whole the various state or federal entities for Medicaid reimbursement, you cannot use a disclaimer in that instance also. I'd be happy to address any questions.
Any questions about Senate Bill 133?
Representative Krieger. If that inheritance is part of another, in other words, several people are named to inherit it, farmland, forest land like I own, because one member of the family screwed up, how's that going to affect that inheritance of the others if he can't disclaim that? Are they going to have to break the property up and sell it?
Chairman McPherson, Representative Krieger, no. The disclaimer only affects that person's, the persons who it was receiving the portion. So if there are, say, three children, there is farmland, it was equally divided among the three children. If one, in the subject, in the time where you would have a disclaimer, if it, it goes to A, B, and C. If they can effectually disclaim, it just goes to A and B, if C effectually disclaims. If the disclaimer cannot be used, then that A's portion, whatever it is, can be used to satisfy their debt. They will have a judgment, an obligation that they will have to pay.
Mr. Chair, so it would affect the other family members who had no wrongdoing whatsoever.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger, in the instance of as you propose, I assume you propose a single farm, for example, that went if they divided it by parcels, it would not affect them. If it was a single unit where they would be tenants in common, it would make subject to execution that portion of the wrongdoer's portion. So in that instance, yes, it would potentially affect the others.
But it would seem to me that it would affect it in this sense, that it would place, if it can't be disclaimed, so it would go to, say, if there are three children, three siblings, and it would go to you couldn't put in by disclaimer of the third who was a criminal offender, shift it to just the other two, then that other third interest would land in the hands of someone else, which would be the criminal offender, who's still a family member, but then it could be executed on, as a judgment can, against that piece of property. So it could, have the consequence when you're spreading it out to non-family members of having another person who's a co-owner of the property then, or executing on the property, to that would be forcing a sale of that third interest. Now, the most logical buyer for that third interest would be the other two siblings.
Correct, Chairman.
Okay. Any further questions of Mr. Boss on 133? Short amount of time here. Mr. Neely, you had offered. Okay, let's see where we go with this. Let me close the public hearings on Senate Bill 133A and 131A, and open a work session. I'm sorry, 130A and 133A, and I will open a work session on 130A and 133A. Now, these are related but a little different bills, members, and obviously one of them had much tougher sledding in the Senate than the other one did. It drew only one no vote, and 133 did. These seem to me like they're not bills of great consequence, but they're useful as far as they go, but open it for consideration of the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'll move Senate Bill 133A to the House floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves Senate Bill 133A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just, I would have some concern how this is going to affect family-held entities and natural resources, forcing them to split it up. I don't know if that was ever discussed in the Senate hearings at all, but I think it have a negative effect. If you got one bad apple in a family, you got a 30, 40-year investment of stewardship of land and then have to sell it or have to rebuy it because of the wrong action of a family member.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, and I just want to clarify that if I knew that ahead of time as the person who's going to pass this on, I could change my will.
That's right.
There's nothing that would stop me from changing that trust or that will to cut that person out to avoid that problem down the road. This is something that is very narrow, I think, that somebody is inheriting some stuff, and we have crime victims who I understand Representative Krieger's point there, that if they weren't able to be cut out and it got on, it would cause some complications. But on the other hand, we have some crime victims here that maybe are deserving of something. So,
any further discussion? Then we have a motion before us from Representative Cameron to move Senate Bill 133A to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Hall. Aye.
Representative
Hall.
Aye.
Representative
Prater.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Brookman.
Excuse
me.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Aye.
Senate Bill 133A moves to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. And Representative Cameron, would you carry that bill?
Sure.
Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on 133A. We're still in work session on 130A. Are people comfortable with action on this bill?
I am.
I'm going to give a yes, but I'll be sure that we didn't miss anything, but I'll give a yes.
Okay, very good.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to support the bill, and I just want to emphasize that with the consent of the victim part of it, because if you don't emphasize that part, it just looks like we're giving the ability to reduce the restitution, and I don't think that that's the intent. I kind of read between the lines, but I do support the bill.
That's quite right. Representative Flores.
Thank you. And with the example that Council Stanford gave in a current example in Multnomah County, you said that oftentimes, because of the movement, flow, and time frame of all of these negotiations, that a call to the victim would be made, and are you happy with it, or what do you need, and are you happy with this, and he says okay or not, and agreement is evident. So where in that process, if it's a time factor in coming to that conclusion, would the written consent of the victim be able to be obtained?
Representative Flores, your question, if I may, was exactly a concern that I had when the bill was first introduced, and I spoke with Mr. Boss about that, because it just is not possible a lot of the time, and it would require the victim to come to the courthouse, and they don't want to do that a lot of the time, and you're talking to them. The bill, so the world that I was speaking of, where you have numerous cases and you're resolving them, pleading them, making calls, restitution enough, et cetera. Well, first of all, I'm speaking only about Multnomah County, so I don't know about how other counties handle it. Multnomah County, if there's a crime and there's restitution involved, immediately a restitution packet is sent to the victim and they are supposed to fill it out and return it to you. That happens maybe about a third of the time, and then you have to follow up with them. But in any event, that those quick, high-volume cases are excluded under the amended version of 130. What I mean by that is a person felony, the most serious crimes that we have, those aren't handled in that fashion. I'm talking about all the misdemeanors and bar fights and fist fights and reckless drivings. Those are the ones where you have numerous cases and it's this high volume. Person felonies, you do have more time with the victim. You do spend more time talking to them. One would hope that you're getting the victim's input in those cases at a much more detailed level, and the DA is not agreeing to any kind of restitution that the victim hasn't agreed to already to begin with. But this is a step to, I suppose, ensure that that happened. You have more time on the person felony cases, is, I guess, as much as I can say about it.
Thank you, Council. I appreciate that enhancement there. And then I guess, Mr. Chair, I would concur with Representative Bonamici that we somehow focus that this is to benefit of the victim's recovery as opposed to reducing the
perpetrators. It's important that if this goes to the floor that people understand that, because I suspect that's not what was not understood in the Senate side, is my guess about
could
why
well be.
It drew the opposition it did. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 130 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores moves Senate Bill 130A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair
Barker? Excused.
Vice Chair
Wigman?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. Senate Bill 130A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Flores, would you be willing to deliver that explanation? That'd be very helpful. Close the work session on Senate Bill 130A. I'm just going to tap in and out because we had nobody signed up, so we work through our notice requirements. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 296A and close a public hearing on Senate Bill 296A and roll over the work session until tomorrow on Senate Bill 296A. That concludes our agenda, committee. We are adjourned.